I get to do what I started out doing, playing rock music with teenagers. And here I am at the other end of the spectrum, and I am playing rock music with teenagers. And yes, I do think that's very fun. The biggest thing that's fun to me, though, is to see what happens to the kids in this two-week crash course.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, the stories, and events of Central Iowa. That clip was of Al Biala, director of the Iowa School of Rock, a two-week performance workshop for teenagers that is culminating in a performance tonight and tomorrow night at Zeke's. More on their story in the second half of the hour. I'm one of your hosts today, Greta Anderson, and I'm here with Tom Beal, my co-host.
Good morning, Greta. You know, one of the most neglected of the five freedoms of the First Amendment is the right to petition the government. And in the first half of this hour, we're going to be exploring a citizen-led, citizen-funded effort to do just that, petition our legislators about an issue that affects all of us, climate change.
That's right. We have in our studio two Ames residents from the Citizens Climate Lobby, Stephen Biggs and Deb Fink. But before we turn to them, let's start the hour, as we often do, with a word from correspondent Pat Schlarbaum, who has a quick insight to offer us from the natural world.
Yeah, recently out at Ada Hayden, a bird was putting on quite a show. From 100 feet in the air, this hovering angler folded its wings, silently slipped from the sky like lightning. And suddenly a 4-foot portion of the lake exploded into prism plumes of diamondized droplets. And completely immersed, the feathered predator floated to the surface, preparing to emerge with a fish in its talons. The bird pushed against the water with its wings and seemingly hopped through the water's cohesive forces. And then it started flapping, and a third and fourth labored wing beat increased the height from the lake's surface. And in a remarkable finale, the fishing raptor shook off excess water like a wriggling dog while gliding ever so closely to the pool's shimmering surface again. It positioned the fish straight ahead, torpedo style in its talons. The osprey began stroking upward, its slippery prey secured. And with the most efficient style, this lean flying machine had spied its quarry and with amazing desire just took it. You think your tackle box contains everything you need to catch a fish, but this was truly an incredible display of fishing perfection. So I hope all the listeners get a chance to get out to Ada Hayden to enjoy all the wildlife, including ospreys, there and at Peterson's Pits also. And that's our focus on phenology for today.
That was Pat Schlarbaum. This is Local Talk, and we're here with local activists from the Climate Change Lobby who have been busy talking to legislators in Washington about this issue, which affects us all.
Well, welcome to you, Stephen Biggs and Deb Fink. Thanks for coming. You've both been to Washington on the issue of climate change, and I look forward to hearing about how that visit went. But first, can you share with us what exactly you were asking our lawmakers to consider?
So the Citizens Climate Lobby is advocating for a specific piece of legislation, and that piece of legislation has three basic components. The first component is a fee levied against carbon. Various fossil fuels, oil, gas, coal, when they're burnt, carbon enters the atmosphere, and this is a greenhouse gas, and this contributes significantly to climate change. The idea is if you levy a fee against fuels to the extent that they dump carbon into the atmosphere, fuels that don't require or sources of energy that don't require dumping carbon into the atmosphere will become more competitive and thus will people will invest them the more heavily, they'll be more used. And fees that do dump carbon into the atmosphere, people will invest in them less, they'll be less used because they become more costly. And so that's the first basic component. And there's a lot of details about that component that are important that we can talk about, but that's the basic component. The second basic component is a dividend. So the question is, if you're levying these fees against fuels that are going to dump carbon into the atmosphere, what do you do with the revenue that's generated from levying the fees? And what we advocate doing is returning all of the revenue to every household in the U.S. So 100% of the revenue is taken and returned to U.S. households, an equal share for each adult and a half share for each child up to two children. So a family like mine, which has myself, my wife, and two children, would get three shares. A family with just two adults would get two shares, and so on. So technically, you'll hear the phrase carbon tax sometimes, and I'm okay with that phrase as long as people understand that from a technical point of view, this isn't a tax. A tax is designed to raise revenue, which is then used for something else. This fee raises no revenue because all of the money generated is returned to people.
Does it ultimately, though, increase the cost of the alternative energy? Let me put it another way. We know that coal is in abundance in our country, and there are other more easily obtained sources of energy. And the alternatives, some critics say, there just aren't enough alternative sources of power to replace those. So wouldn't it become more expensive for alternative sources of power to replace the carbon-based ones?
It's true that the cost of energy would rise. There's no doubt about that. And that sounds like a bad thing because everything becomes more expensive. The shoes I'm wearing take energy to produce. If the cost of energy goes up, then the price of the shoes goes up a little bit. And now there's what we were banking on, what Citizens Climate Lobby was banking on, was that the dividend would compensate for the increased cost of goods. And to check on whether what we were banking on was true or not, Citizens Climate Lobby hired an economic modeling group called the Regional Economic Models Incorporated, which is a very prestigious economic modeling group. It's nonpartisan. It's used by, for example, the Iowa Department of Transportation as well as various national organizations. And what they found, in fact, is that over two-thirds of households would actually make money on the deal. So basically, the two-thirds of households who spend the least, which tend to be those who have the least, would actually be receiving more money from the dividend than the cost of goods would increase their output.
How would this money be returned to the people? Would it be in checks from the government, or how would that work?
That's exactly right. It's just like an ordinary dividend payment for stocks, except it's monthly, and dividend payments for stocks can come in any schedule. So a monthly check from the government.
Well, you and Deb were in Washington with other members of people from Iowa to talk with legislators and so on about this. What kind of reaction are you folks getting?
Different reactions from different people. So there were various we met with a lot of representatives, and some of them were more informed about the proposal and some of them were less informed. And I think my sense was that those who were more informed primarily had political concerns. So they were concerned, for example, about the word tax. Nobody likes to hear the idea that there will be a new tax. Luckily for us, even Republicans who have signed a pledge to not increase taxes are okay with this because, again, technically it's a fee. There's no new revenue for government spending, no new government bureaucracy, nothing that violates their pledge. Those who are less informed tended to be just excited about the possibility of having a market-based solution to a climate problem rather than more government regulation. So that's another sort of interesting aspect to our proposal, is that instead of having increased government regulation to solve these sorts of problems, you have the market doing it by giving an appropriate price to the damage caused by carbon.
I've got a question going back to the whole concept. You mentioned fuels as kind of the focus of the change of the fee or tax. There are a lot of other point sources of carbon in our economy. If you took down all the redwood forest, you know, that would be a huge carbon loss. I mean, carbon, I guess, you know, gain into the atmosphere. Likewise, you know, you think about all of the cattle in feedlots. They are producing a lot of methane, which is even worse than carbon dioxide, putting that into the atmosphere. Are those kinds of point sources covered by the plan that the Citizen Climate Lobby is promoting?
They are not. There are people who advocate for things like, for example, a meat tax for precisely the reason you mentioned. Methane dumps a lot of – methane is actually more intense greenhouse gas than oil, for example. And because of that, people want something like a meat tax so that animal farming goes down and you get these benefits. But Citizens Climate Lobby is primarily interested in sources of energy that are going to be burned and thereby dump CO2 in the atmosphere.
Thanks. Yeah.
Well, you know, coming back to alternative sources of energy for a moment, I wanted to ask you, a lot of times people are talking about these alternative sources of energy such as windmills, wind farms, and so on, and the challenge of getting those funded and up and running and making them competitive with the existing carbon-based fuels. This process that you're proposing, though, would not divert money raised by taxing carbon sources, because you said the money would be returned as dividends to the citizens. So how would you encourage these alternative sources of energy to be developed?
Okay, so yeah, that's another good point, and it goes back to the idea that this is a market-based solution. So the present strategy has heavy regulations. So the EPA passes regulations on coal-fired power plants, for example, and then subsidies. So that's the present strategy. The strategy that CCL advocates is to create a genuine level playing field. So a coal-fired power plant costs all of us by dumping extra carbon into the atmosphere. If we levy a fee against the carbon so that that cost becomes built into the product, so if you're going to mine coal, you need to pay for that cost that's ordinarily socialized and that all of us have to pay for, the cost of coal will go up significantly. Well, solar panels, for example, or wind energy result in significantly less carbon being dumped into the atmosphere. So now the fee isn't levied against these things, and because of that, the comparative price ends up being lower. And as soon as the policy is put in place, investors will see that the smart money is in alternative sources of energy, and the money will just go that way. Instead of having the government subsidize it, the market will drive the change.
You make it sound so logical, and you do it in a calm manner. You're not being strident about it, as some passionate people can be about causes they care about. And so I would think, as you lay out these arguments, that people, both individuals and those in office, would be persuaded. Is that the kind of reaction you're getting?
You know, I think most people are persuaded. So, for example, it turns out that a huge number of conservative intellectuals are in favor of our proposal. For our legislation, one of our advisors, for example, is George Shultz, Reagan's Secretary of State. Art Laffer says, even if there is no climate change, this is a good proposal just because it's good for the economy. You have all of these conservative intellectuals on board. The problem is just this. Even though about 70% of Republicans believe that climate change is man-made and we need to do something about it, the 30% who don't believe that are vocal. And their members of Congress are very worried about losing that 30%, because they will lose them if they make a move, is their view. I don't know if that view is accurate, but that's their view. And they're just afraid. They're afraid. I think if you could get some conservatives to really take the lead on this, you could get significant movement. But right now, I think there's a heavy lobbying industry designed to manipulate people, to make them have false beliefs about climate change. And they're effective with a certain percentage of people. And that percentage of people takes this to be a deeply important issue and is very vocal. And politicians just don't want to lose them.
I'd like to address a more realistic, maybe, reservation that one might have about the system. And that is, for instance, the Social Security system has been, you know, you pay into and then you get back. And we all know how that has gone. Our Social Security funds are spent to wage war and things like that, even though Al Gore at one time was talking about a lockbox. You know, I don't think such a thing is even possible. So I'm wondering, how do you create that secure lockbox that would keep these carbon funds separate from the regular federal economy and return them in toto to the people?
I could go with that.
Thanks, Deb.
Yeah, this is Deb. That's always a possibility, and that is why citizens can't go to sleep on this, because if that money's there, somebody will be trying to get it, and so it's an ongoing problem.
And you can have written into the legislation mechanisms to make it a lockbox. So British Columbia has a very interesting mechanism here. So written into their legislation, so they have basically a carbon tax that gets returned. It's not exactly like the proposal that we're advocating, but they have something similar.
British Columbia.
And
okay.
People love it because they get this monthly check, and it's exceeding the cost of increasing.
It's a province independently of Canada.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And written into the law is, I don't remember the exact number, but if any of the money is diverted, the premier of British Columbia has to give back a certain percentage of his or her salary. And it's a very large percentage. It's something like half of his or her salary. I don't imagine.
Fascinating incentive.
Yeah, it's a massive incentive not to do this. So there are ways that you can write into the law to make it a lockbox.
We've got to be creative about it, though.
That's right.
You know, I was thinking of one of the challenges that legislators have or lawmakers have is when certain parts of the country are more severely affected when you make a policy change. And I was thinking of West Virginia that's so reliant on coal as their source of income. And a lot of these are poor people. These are terrible jobs, I understand, going down in the coal mines. But these people rely on this, and they're afraid that if you kill off the coal industry, what will they do for a livelihood? Possibly in North Dakota as well, now that fracking is becoming such a big source of income and so on. How do you respond to those concerns?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And part of this is what philosophers would call an empirical question, a question about what the facts actually are. And we don't know what the facts actually are, state by state or county by county, but we do know what the facts actually are, region by region. And the region economics economic models incorporated that did the analysis for us found that they divide the U.S. into 9 regions, and they found that only one region loses. So the only region that loses is basically Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana. And they don't lose by much. They don't get – every other region gets pretty significant economic gains. The Midwest in particular does exceptionally well. But this one region in the Southwest, which really relies heavily on oil production, does lose out a bit. And what I say to that is there are going to be costs to, you know, saving the world. And doing nothing also has severe costs, and there's people all over the world who are suffering severely. Of course, not every individual who right now works at a coal plant is going to get some great job working on solar panels. But there are going to be plenty of people who do get great jobs working on solar panels, and that will compensate for some of the loss in people working at a coal. There are a variety of people who are active in CCL who actually meet regularly with oil and gas executives. And some of the executives, I think it's ExxonMobil is one of them, although I'm not sure about that, have come out in favor of our proposal for a few reasons. One is because in the short term, our proposal actually does – natural gas does really well because it releases less CO2 into the atmosphere and the costs of fracking aren't really accounted for.
You mean the cost to our environment in terms of water quality?
Yeah, local environmental costs aren't accounted for because the proposal doesn't build those costs in. And another reason that some oil and gas executives like the proposal is that it would give price stability. It would allow them to predict what the market will be in the future. Presently, since these issues are determined by policy and by government regulation, as governments change, as, you know, Obama goes out and a new president comes in or Obama replaces Bush, the EPA regulations change. And that affects how the pricing goes for their goods. And they, because of that, they can't predict what's going to happen next. Well, if our policy was put in place and that was the means to determine what happens, then they would be able to predict how pricing would change and they'd know where to invest. They'd know, look, we should shift a significant portion of our investment to solar and that's going to be a good investment. Whereas right now, if Obama's in office, maybe solar is a good investment. If the next president's in office and changes policy, maybe we should have left all of our money for, you know, getting more oil.
You seem to be presuming, though, that your program, if accepted, would be secure. And why wouldn't it be just as vulnerable to change with the next administration as what other policies are?
So laws absolutely can change, but it's much easier for a president to change policy than it is for the Congress to change the law. Think of how difficult it is to get a bunch of members of Congress together to accept a new law.
Or repeal Obamacare.
Or exactly.
For listeners who are just tuning in, we're with the Climate Change Lobby, two activists from Ames who are proposing a, not a tax necessarily, but a fee on fuels that dump carbon into the atmosphere. The revenues gained through this national fee would be returned to citizens in a dividend on a per-person basis. So every person would receive the same amount of money regardless of how much fuel they use. We're here with Stephen Biggs and Deb Fink.
And I was going to ask a question that you may have touched on earlier, and it has to do with whether manufacturing companies in the U.S. would be at a disadvantage because they would be required to comply with this anti-carbon energy program, whereas other countries would not. How do you resolve that?
Yes, so that's a great question, and this is actually one of my favorite parts of the proposal. So it includes what's called a border adjustment, which means that goods being imported to the U.S. from countries that don't have a carbon fee in place would have the fee levied against them at our border before they come into the U.S. So as far as domestic sales, U.S. goods would be as competitive as imported goods. As far as exports go, U.S. companies would have the amount of increase in cost of good that resulted from the carbon fee refunded to them. So as far as exports go, U.S. products would be not disadvantaged. Now, one of the reasons that this is my favorite part of the proposal, or one of my favorite parts, is that it makes it immediately internationalized because the U.S. is the dominant economy in the world. So often you hear we can't take significant action on climate change because China and India won't come along. And if China and India don't come along, problems aren't going to be solved anyway because they're such big emitters, such big polluters. Well, China would face a choice. They could institute a carbon fee like ours, or they could pay the carbon fee to us for all the goods that we import, and then U.S. citizens would get the money. Well, it would be pretty hard for them to say to their citizens, we're going to not have a carbon fee in place so that we can pay fees to U.S. citizens that we could be paying to you, or we could be using for social services or whatever else.
And I can see how this carbon fee would kind of stimulate more local and national industry as opposed to shipping from far away, because there's all of the cost of the transportation for items to get to the United States. It seems that the transportation cost would be worked in, right,
yeah, to that's exactly right.
The price, and that would favor local production of goods.
That's exactly right. It absolutely would.
You know, many of the big industries today are worldwide. In fact, we keep reading about companies that are figuring out clever ways to relocate to foreign countries so they don't have to pay their full share of American taxes. I'm still concerned about these big international companies that they don't think in terms of one country or another. They think global. And how will you be able to pressure them to comply with this program?
I guess I'm trying to think of a scenario where it would make sense for a company to move. And the scenario might be like this. If you have a country whose exports rarely come to the U.S., then the mechanism that I mentioned before for getting them to adopt a carbon fee wouldn't apply. So you could maybe imagine American businesses fleeing to that particular kind of country. And I guess I don't take that concern too seriously, because if we were Sweden proposing this, or Germany, or Brazil, or China, or many other countries that are doing well economically and have significant imports, but aren't the U.S., which is by far the biggest importer in the world, then I might have this kind of concern. But there's so few countries out there who don't have the U.S. as their sort of main source of export. One way to think about it is, it seems in general like it's a very bad thing that we're such big consumers, that we, you know, use so much of the world's resources. But we're kind of turning that to our advantage here. So I guess I can imagine a situation like this where you'd have that kind of country, but I'm not sure there really will be such situations.
What kind of reaction are you getting at the local level when you get a chance to talk to individuals? Do they understand it, or is it just a little too complicated for them?
I've found that just about everybody that I've explained the proposal to has understood it. I don't think that it's too complicated. Now, if too complicated means it takes more than 30 seconds to answer people's questions, which sometimes it does mean that because people don't want to listen, then I could imagine it being too complicated.
This is an error of short attention spans, remember.
But given 5 minutes, I think people can get the gist, and they typically have questions. Like, I think most people are very smart, and you know, you explain something to them, they have questions, they ask the right questions, and then I think they tend to find the answers compelling. So I think people tend to be on board. I don't know what your experiences are, Deb, with this.
Explaining this to people, I think it is complicated, and there are a lot of ideas out there, and there are people who don't believe in climate change. And I think there will be problems with this. I mean, when we say, you know, that the United States is the biggest consumer, actually, war is an incredibly great consumer, and we export most of that overseas. So I don't think that we can be sanguine that this is going to solve all the problems in the future. I mean, I think there will be ongoing climate challenges and political challenges always. But this, it doesn't detract from the fact that this is a major good step forward.
Yeah, Deb Fink is from the American Friends Service Committee.
Friends Committee on National Legislation.
So, of course, war and peace are vital issues to your work. I kind of have to side with Deb in this debate on how well people will understand. I mean, we have such examples from listeners and viewers of Fox News, you know, people who are still convinced that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and people who think that Obamacare is socialism, even though all of the money is going to insurance companies. So I don't know how we can possibly avoid the propaganda machine or outpower it unless our electorate becomes much more rational.
Yeah, I guess the way I think about it is there's a massive amount of money being spent to delude people about climate change. And if our proposal gets legs, there'll be a massive amount of money spent to delude people about the proposal. But despite that massive amount of money spent, I mean, the money spent to delude people dwarfs the money spent to inform people in these issues, right? And the same thing goes for national security issues and war and peace issues, of course. But despite the massive amount of money spent to delude people, the majority of people in the U.S. believe that climate change is real, man-made, and an urgent issue. The majority of Republicans believe that. At the Citizens Climate Lobby Conference, there was a panel on Latinos, and they people from the National Resource Defense Council presented some data. Over 90% of Latinos believe that climate change is real, man-made. And surprise, surprise, who do they take most seriously on this? Scientists. That's who they listen to, and that's why they believe it. So I guess I'm hopeful about persuasion because despite all of this effort spent to delude people, you have a majority in both political parties believing that it's real, man-made, and an important issue. Of course, Fox News and massive propaganda machine to delude people is going to delude some people, but my hope is that it won't delude enough.
So tell us about the time that you spent on Capitol Hill with our legislators talking to them about this issue.
Yes, I met with all of the Iowa legislators or members of their staff, except for Tom Latham. We had people who did meet with Latham's office, but I wasn't in that meeting. And I had largely positive experiences. The staffers or the members of Congress asked the right kind of questions. They were genuinely interested. We had different requests from different political candidates. So for Democrats, we were requesting that they seek out people who have introduced roughly similar legislation and ask the person who introduced it about it and support that legislation. For Republicans, we were asking that they introduce our specific legislation. We weren't asking that of Democrats because the CCL committee thinks, and I think probably rightly, that as a political matter of fact, right now, any climate legislation introduced by a Democrat is dead. It's not going to pass. And I'm not quite as hopeful as many of the Citizens Climate Lobby folk, but many of them really believe this legislation is going to pass in the next few years. And because of that, they want it to be introduced in a way that it will pass. We didn't get any Republican member of Congress, for example, Steve King, the Ames representative, who's my representative, to say, yes, I'll introduce your legislation. But their staffers listened. They had the right kinds of questions. They expressed the kinds of concerns you would expect from conservatives. The Steve King staffer said, for example, I think Steve King would say climate change isn't real because humans contribute a small portion of greenhouse gases to the, you know, atmosphere. But we were able to respond effectively to these questions, and the staffer said, you know, I see the response. I don't see how, you know, I don't see where to move next. I think the reaction was largely positive. I think the main goal that we achieved was sort of softening people's attitudes. So if we get to a point where the legislation is introduced, we won't have as robust opposition from some of the folks we met with as we might otherwise have had.
I'm particularly intrigued by the reception that you're getting from the conservatives on Capitol Hill, because it seems to me they tend to resist the argument that there is climate change underway and that we need to do anything about it. This is just a natural ebb and flow of climate change over the centuries. And so when you say that you can meet with the staff and occasionally even with the Congress members themselves, and they don't throw you out of their office. It's an intriguing reaction. And so you're suggesting you're taking time step by step to persuade these folks and their staff that this is a logical, practical, sensible, not a crazy idea that might be something they could support in the future.
Yeah, so there's several reasons why I think the conservative members of Congress aren't as worried about this kind of proposal as they are about some other kinds of proposals. So one reason is that it has a lot of backing from prominent conservative intellectuals. And they can say, look, you know, George Shultz, Art Laffer, Henry Paulson, all of these folks are in support of this kind of policy. So I'm not being unconservative by supporting this kind of policy. Another reason is I think, you know, many of them, even though they publicly say, I think there is no climate change, privately, they know that it's real. They trust the 98% of scientists who say it's real man-made and going to have severe consequences. And because of that, they know something is going to have to be done going forward. Even if they think climate change isn't real, they know that something's likely to be done because the majority of people believe that it's real. So their choice then is between, you know, EPA regulations, which they hate, and a market-based solution, which takes a cost that's real and puts it in the product, the price of the product. And faced with that choice, they're intrigued by the idea that they can go forward without heavy government regulation.
Well, I was about to ask whether the candidates for office, and there are several now running for either open seats or they're challenging incumbents, if you spend any time talking with those folks.
We have requested a meeting with the opponent for Steve King in the next election, Jim Maurer. And his campaign manager has said that it's very likely we'll be able to meet with him and talk about this, but we haven't met with him yet. Other members of CCL from other districts in Iowa meet with all of the candidates that they can for each election. And not just candidates, but, you know, editors of newspapers, all sorts of different people to try and...
That's an interesting question. What kind of reaction are you getting from the editorial writers across the state?
The reactions, I haven't met with any editorial writers, but I'm told by the folks in Des Moines that they've had really positive reactions meeting with the editors from the Des Moines Register. And, you know, that helps them see that they, when they get letters from CCL members, that this isn't a crazy proposal and it's maybe worth publishing so people can see the value of the proposal.
We have to wrap up pretty soon here, but I just to get a better sense, are you a volunteer for the organization?
Yes. Citizens Climate Lobby has a very small staff and thousands of volunteers. I think it's over 6,000 right now. And it's grown very, very rapidly over the last few years.
Okay. So where does the funding come from for the overall structure of the organization?
There's a few private donors. There's the founder, Marshall Saunders, gives a lot of his own money. But most of the money, for us to go to D.C., comes from our own pockets. We pay for it because we think it's important and worth doing.
Well, that's quite admirable. Thank you very much for your service to our community and for coming onto the show.
Yeah, thank you for having
pleasure
us.
Pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having us.
Jenny said when she was just 5 years old, there was nothing happening at all. Every time she puts on the radio, there was nothing going down at all. Not at all. Then one fine morning she puts on a New York station. You know she don't believe what she heard at all. She started shaking to that fine, fine music. You know her life was saved by rock and roll.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Greta Anderson, here with my co-host, Tom Beal.
Well, that last song tells a familiar story. How many youths have lived that story in their lifetime?
It's true. We hear a lot about the celebrity lives that rock destroys, but what about the millions it saves? Our next story is about a couple, Al and Melita Biela, who, it could be argued, are saving lives and changing the world with their business, Ames Music School. Year-round, they teach music, voice and including rock music to young people. But for 2 weeks in the summer, they ramp it up to something they call Iowa School of Rock. They've been doing this for 8 years and have seen a lot of kids go through the hardest parts of their lives with a passion and confidence that could only come from two special ingredients.
Would those ingredients be rock and roll?
That's right. So at the beginning of the 2 weeks, these kids are put into bands based on like-mindedness. And this year, there are 23 kids enrolled in the camp. They're all teenagers. They pick their songs. They shape their group identity with a band name and logo. And then they practice every day to build something they'll be proud to perform at the end.
So you visited the studio on Main Street to see what they were up to.
That's right. And I put together a mix of some of the conversations I had with the kids and their fearless leaders. Let's listen.
All the songs we're doing are covers from metal bands.
And the name of your band again?
Life in Death.
That's their heavy metal singer warming up.
Yes.
I was probably a lot like these kids, just getting a guitar and having garage bands. And then after high school, I went on to play in bands for about 14 years, just what I did for a living. And then after that, I wasn't quite sure what I was qualified to do. But it did seem like I was probably qualified to teach music at that point. So I started teaching through a music store that used to be here on Main Street, Main Street Music. And then we opened our own studio, and now we're doing this.
And I've seen you in the studio pick up various instruments to help the kids out. Are you pretty proficient or reasonably proficient at everything?
Well, there are several instruments that I've dabbled in very heavily, yes, including while I was a paid performer. I was playing, could be playing bass or guitar or keyboards, you know, and then I also picked up saxophone, and I love drumming, and there's other instruments too. Yeah, I mean, I sort of look at it like, you know, a carpenter doesn't just run a hammer or a saw. We're trying to build something here, and we got all these tools.
So you're a utility music guy.
Yeah, I'm a utility music guy.
Very good.
So this all started, the School of Rock started back in 2006. That was a couple of years after the School of Rock movie. Did Jack Black and that movie have anything to do with this uprising of rock camps?
That's a great question. You know, I didn't see the movie till after I started this thing and called it School of Rock. And I knew there was a movie out there. But actually, a friend of mine in Atlanta, who has a huge teaching studio, was telling me about this School of Rock thing he did one summer with a few bands, and I thought, that's what I want to do. And the main thing was having something to call it, to identify it in a way that people would get it without a huge explanation. So I love just being able to put that name on it, School of Rock. And then we thought, yeah, we better see this movie, see what we're getting into here. And of course, it's a very hilarious movie. And the other thing that we also looked at that point was the rock school. Which actually, the School of Rock movie really was inspired by this actual rock school. It's the nationally franchised rock school. And outside of the fact that they have high dollar budget and they can get actual rock stars to come and participate in their program, I think we're doing all the stuff that they do as well or better than they do it, honestly. Did I say that? Yeah.
All right. Ames rocks. It's kind of interesting. I mean, we've got some aging rock and rollers and wanting to pass on their skills, you know, not really wanting to grow up and put on a suit, and you found an audience and you're going for it.
That is all part of it. You're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, we'd have kids in lessons and they'd be telling us their woes about trying to get together with their friends and have bands, and I mean, they needed some tools. And yes, this is really fun for us. And, you know, there's, you know, a couple of my staff people are really, they do the band thing, and this really makes sense to them, and they love working with the kids. So it is, it's this combination of things. It's the fact that You know, I get to do what I started out doing, playing rock music with teenagers. And here I am at the other end of the spectrum, and I am playing rock music with teenagers. And, yes, I do think that's very fun. The biggest thing that's fun to me, though, is to see what happens to the kids in this two-week crash course thing. I mean, that is the thing that I did not anticipate going into this, is what a dynamic experience it would be for kids. I mean, I knew they'd get a lot out of it musically, clearly, and I knew how to map that out and do that. But the rest of it, the group dynamics of it, the being a leader, being a team player, the fact that it's a little bit different kind of, it's such a close-knit project. It's not like playing in school band or being in a play. I mean, this is like you and this handful of other people, and you have to have a serious meeting of the minds to pull this off. And just watching what takes place there and being a part of that, that's the most amazing part to me.
Can you describe a snapshot from that process?
Well, sure, I can too. I'm just going to think about what was just happening yesterday with this band that's over there getting themselves going. And David wanted to sing a song, and he wanted to play his guitar, and I could see that he wasn't going to be able to pull off both. And he knew he could do it better without his guitar, but he did not want to put down his guitar. And he was struggling with it, and we were almost like kind of butting heads over it. But I thought, we're going to let this run its course, because everybody, including David, and he's a very mature, young, teenage kid who could see. But finally, by the end of the day yesterday, he announced that he was embracing the role of being a lead singer in his band. So he put down his guitar and he embraced something else. And that was a big deal for him. I mean, he had to go through that in front of his friends, you know, and suffer through, you know, saying, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this. And then come around and say, no, this is going to work. I'm going to really make this work.
So he's not playing guitar on that song?
No, he puts his guitar down, and he's going to be able to move around on stage. And Melita says, make sure you get him a wireless mic so he really has a sense of freedom on that. And we will. Yeah. And there's just things, some of my favorite comments are when some kid is singing a rock song and his dad is saying to me, I didn't know my kid had that in him. How cool is that? You know?
They get to express a part of them.
They want to do it, you know, they so want to do it, and yet, and for a lot of them, singing is like, they would really want to do it, and it's so terrifying. So that's all, there's always things around, but it's not just that. I mean, it could be any number. It could be the opposite thing where, you know, I'm the big lead guitar player, but I have to understand that there's more than that to being a part of a band and to making the whole band really work the best it can. And so sometimes you're editing things out and you're realizing that less is more, and kids are, and they have their other pet things that they have to let go of for other reasons, for the part to be a part of the whole and to make it really be as powerful as it can be. And they catch on to that. Or the other neat thing that'll happen, I had a band a few years back, all the kids were really advanced players, except for this one guitar player, who was the only guitar player in their band. They had keyboards and bass and vocals, and this guitar player who was like a beginner. And nobody copped an attitude. Instead, they totally rallied around. They like made the whole thing fit together so that when they started their concert and that kid is putting out the opening chords of this Pink Floyd song, you couldn't have picked out that he was the novice in this group of experienced players, because they just worked together to figure out how to make it really happen. Okay, that kind of thing. And watching kids do that, I have more confidence in this every time we do it, because I know it's the kids. I don't do it. The kids, we create the environment. We set the ground rules up. And we put them in this sonic playground, and they really figure out how to make it work. It's really cool. You know, the thing is, they want it. They want the show, and they want all this stuff. And then they start seeing all these hurdles they got to get over to get to it. But they want it. And so they're going to do what it takes. And I love that whole motivation factor. That's part of what makes it the environment it is.
So describe for me what's going to happen on Friday and Saturday night.
Okay, on Friday we'll move into Zeke's in the afternoon, and we'll do kind of a dress rehearsal sound check afternoon. All the bands get to see what the other bands are doing, and a lot of them really love that part of it. They just get to hang out with the other rockers for the day. And then at 7 p.m., we will crank up the lights and sound in Zeke's, and we will give a full production rock concert. And every day now, we're still raising the bar every day. And they're going to peak about then, and they're going to sound awesome. And we'll do it again on Saturday night. I love giving them that second chance to see if they can top what they did on Friday night.
Right, right. So lights and everything, stage show?
Oh, yeah, you bet. It'll be a real rock show, absolutely. There's not a lot of downtime, you know. We stage those bands one right after the other, and it's a high-energy show. The kids are ramped up for it.
And probably all their friends are going to come.
Yep, friends will come. Family will be there supporting them. You bet. You are more than welcome to join us at Zeke's. Let's pack the place and cheer on these young rockers. They will blow you away.
I teach the band class, and that's where they do all the, you know, learn about performing, they do the naming of their band, etc. And part of what I have them do is interact with each other. We do a lot of crazy, funny things that make them uncomfortable and they think are silly, like mirroring, a mirroring technique that you see in a lot of drama, where they stand face to face and they have to, one person is the leader, one person is the follower, and the leader makes a certain movement or a certain sound, and the other person follows it as closely as possible. Well, in order to do that, you have to look at each other. You have to look at each other in the eyes. And that is really, actually, can be really uncomfortable, especially at that age, especially between boys and girls. But I believe that it fosters friendships, and it fosters a really nice way of relating that kind of cuts through a lot of the junk. So they can just talk to each other, be bandmates, be friends, and share common interests.
Song, and they've taken it really seriously, and they've really worked hard to sing it in the right spirit, in the spirit in which it was intended, which is is critical for that song.
What is the story behind the song? Who can tell me about it?
It's like about war in Ireland, and I think the song was dedicated for two boys who died in a bombing, and how war is such a bad thing, and it's like a zombie, like it's always in your mind, it's always going on, no matter if you think about it, you don't want to think about it, you know that people are dying, you know that they're suffering.
Whether you can see it or not.
Also, I think it's about PTSD, because saying in your head, zombie.
That's really insightful.
Like, as soon as I heard those lyrics, I'm like, oh my god, I know what that's like.
Sarah.
All right, and you play
saxophone, guitar, and I sing.
How long have you been doing these things?
Average 3 years for all of them.
And is rock and roll the reason you do those things, or did you learn your musical instruments through band or school or something?
Well, my saxophone's through band, but guitar and singing, that's all rock and roll.
Have you done this school of rock before?
I did it last year. It was really fun, so I came back. I don't usually get to play with, like, a rock band. There's jazz band at school, but, you know, it's jazz band. But this is rock and roll music. This is what I'm into, and I get to play with other people who are into it, and it's awesome.
I saw that you are a lead singer in the girl group.
Yeah.
And do you sing a lot at home?
Oh, yes, yes. I am a professional shower singer. My shower loves me. My biggest fan.
What do you sing?
Anything. I like oldies music, really. Just like, not necessarily oldies, but like 60s, 70s, 80s. Okay.
So what are your favorite bands to listen to?
Oh, I love Queen. Freddie Mercury is like the best guy ever. Benny King, like the older stuff. I listen to a lot of Charlie Parker for my saxophone. I like Led Zeppelin, too.
Did your mom raise you on rock?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
You want to come in on the conversation? How have you seen Sarah change and grow through the School of Rock?
She's gained so much confidence in her ability to sing and to play the instruments that she's playing. I wouldn't have thought she would play saxophone for this particular group because she did that for school, and she plays the electric guitar for her rock and roll. But she absolutely loves playing sax for the rock and roll bands, too. And it's just great to see your confidence.
Does that carry through to other parts of your life, do you think, Sarah?
Probably. I play a lot louder in jazz band.
What grade are you in?
I'm going into the 9th grade.
Oh, so you're changing schools.
Yeah. And I'm actually changing school districts, too.
So you can use that confidence.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, we will see you out on the stage on Friday and Saturday, then.
Cool, yeah, thank you. Yeah, could definitely come.
Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer. Feeling the rhythm of the music getting stronger. Don't you try to do that conga, please. Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga.
What did you think?
I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah,
I did too.
So I was going to go for it. It was pretty good.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and that was a piece on the Iowa School of Rock, directed by Al Melita Biela.
You know, I'm reminded of an old rock and roll song that said, rock and roll is here to stay, because rock
long
and roll has been
rock.
Around a long time, and it's fascinating that it still has impact on young people today. It's still a valid style of music, and they learned from it, and these kids are learning that through this wonderful school run right here in Ames.
Yeah, and I love, too, how it can now be generational, something that is passed on, and it's still about changing the world because it's still about making people feel at home in the world.
Well, it's one of the great things for kids in the summer to do something significant. And what can be better than learning how to play together in a band and perform on the stage for your friends and for their families and anybody else who wants to come?
Right. So if you would like to be among the audience, show up at Zeke's at 7 p.m. either tonight or Saturday night. Do not have empty pockets. There's a modest admission fee charge.
Right. Well, it should be a lot of fun. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Our first guests were Stephen Biggs and Deb Fink from the Citizens Climate Lobby.
Before that, we heard from KHOI reporter Pat Schlarbaum about an osprey he saw fishing in Ada Hayden.
We've been your hosts, Tom Beal and Greta Anderson. Becca Brown has been our engineer.
Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard an excerpt of Rock and Roll by the Velvet Underground.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join our team, contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Give us a call at 292-2878 or come down to our studio at 410 Douglas Avenue.
As always, your participation as audience and your generous donations are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again
on the radio.